Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Calgiano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. This may be the last time we're actually together for a while.
Yes, right now we are
seated fairly
kitty corner to each
apart.
Other,
yes,
maybe 4 or 5 feet apart.
Yes.
With the microphone between us and Frank's flat. You know, we recorded our episode a little bit over a week ago, talking about the COVID-19 virus and its sort of its historical antecedents, and the intervening week has been unusual.
It's been a long decade.
That's exactly. It's been, you know, pretty much everything has shut down. The stock market has crashed multiple times. Universities have, many of them have closed or switched to online teaching, including ours. The sporting has basically stopped. So basketball shut down. Hockey has shut down. Baseball has postponed opening day. Movie theaters are closed.
Football here, football rugby,
yes,
cricket,
yes,
etc.
All the things. Movies have been delayed openings. You know, people have been told not to congregate in groups of more than, at first it was 100, then it was 50, then it was 20, now it's 10. Now you're basically supposed to sort of hang out by yourself. So we're in a...
We have plans for next week.
Exactly.
Doing this remotely.
So we are in crisis mode. What we thought we'd talk about today is how presidents have responded to crises and the ways in which some have done good jobs in terms of having a response to a crisis, and some have done less well.
Yes, and we may discuss President Trump's response over the past few days as well.
I expect we will.
In that context. Can we begin, and David reminds me that we always tell students not to do this in their essays, but I'm going to do it anyway. Begin by using the dictionary definition of a crisis.
Students never, ever do this. We hate, like, it's almost as bad as since the beginning of time. People, don't do that either.
Right, if we really want to annoy, I should say, read the definition in the passive voice.
Oh.
Anyway, this is a definition that, well, there are multiple definitions in the Oxford English Dictionary, but the one that's most relevant, I think, is this one for a crisis. Quote, a vitally important or decisive stage in the progress of anything, a turning point, also a state of affairs in which a decisive change for better or worse is imminent. Now applied especially to times of difficulty, insecurity, and suspense in politics or commerce. I think that's a decent working definition for us today.
Okay. I mean, the things I'd like to add is that administrations go in with an agenda. Politicians have an agenda of what they think they want to accomplish in a period of time. You know, crisis is a moment that happens that is sort of not on the radar, right? It's the thing that sort of takes you off the rails from whatever the agenda is and makes you sort of reevaluate then pretty much everything else as a consequence.
Well, you say not on the radar, and I know we're going to get to the contemporary situation, and I'm sure we will in the next few minutes, but I don't mean to jump all over that yet or anticipate that yet, but I did read in the press this morning, and quite frankly, I can't remember where it was. I think it was the Washington Post, but I could be wrong, so I apologize, that... During the transition from the Obama to the Trump presidency, they gamed this scenario, this almost exact scenario out, you know, with a pandemic flu outbreak, and the Trump people weren't all that interested in what the Obama people had to say.
Are any of the Trump people from that transition still in power?
Very few. And that is one of the points made in this article, was that most of the people in the room then are no longer in power. But anyway, let's go back. So using that definition of a crisis, David, if we look back at the history of presidents dealing with crises, or Americans more generally, think about my own period, which is, you know, American history, roughly before America, or before the United States, not America, and the early years of the United States. I don't think we have very many lessons to learn from my period. It grieves me to admit this. But so the kind of crises, you know, the Stamp Act crisis of 1765, 66, which is really, if it's a crisis, it's for the British government. Well, it's a political conflict. Mm. It's not a crisis in the sense that we're thinking of it today. The Nootka Sound crisis of 1789-90, which you may not know or care about. And
it's also not.
But
a
it's
crisis.
A diplomatic spot. Bad, yeah. Or the Mississippi.
It's a crisis,
crisis
for 12 people. You know.
Well, yeah. Well, it has important implications for Spain and Britain. But or the Mississippi crisis of 1802, which leads to the Mississippi, the Louisiana Purchase is a crisis. But these are things that play out over a long period of time. I mean, I think if there's one aspect of crises as we consider them in our discussion today, I think the temporal aspect is really important. So there's the fact that we have, as this definition said, a vitally important or decisive stage in the progress of anything. But that progress is part of it. It's the temporal aspect that that there's time pressure in how one responds to whatever this challenge is. And in that
everything
earlier
was
period,
slower
when everything's
century.
Done by pen and ink and sail, it's just not as urgent.
Yeah. So again, when the Stamp Act crisis breaks out, you know, it takes months for news of it to reach London, and then they have to have a response to it, and the repeal, and the whole thing.
Right.
Like all this stuff takes time.
Yeah, the Stamp Act crisis takes a year.
Yes,
now,
but half of that's on the boat over the. Yeah.
Right. A large portion of that is people waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's much to learn. It seems to me, and I defer to your expertise in this particular period, the first real political crisis in America that an American president confronts is that's akin to the kind of things we'll be talking about is the secession crisis and the kind of the way James Buchanan and Abraham Lincoln handled the immediate, the days immediately or the months immediately before the Civil War. Is that fair?
I think so. I mean, one of the things, I think this will sort of preface the other crises we're going to talk about, the presidents who handle crises well tend to be labeled as sort of the best presidents the United States has ever had. People who handle crises badly are the ones who are at the bottom of the list. And Buchanan is usually at the bottom or near the bottom of the list, in part because of how he handled the secession crisis. So the background to this is, in the election in 1860, the Democratic Party splits into two halves. There's the Constitutional Union Party and the Republican Party. Republicans dominate Abraham Lincoln, who wins the election in November, in large part because the Democratic Party split, but isn't going to take office until March, right? So there's a very long window between when the election happens, at least compared to today, a long window between when the election happens and when the new president takes office. And it's during this window that most of the states in the South secede from the Union, starting with South Carolina in December 20th of 1860, while the lame duck President Buchanan is still in office. And it's a really interesting sort of look at how Buchanan responds to this. He's actually warned about the potential of secession even before the election happened. Winfield Scott, who's the sort of leading military authority in the country, General Winfield Scott, warns Buchanan in October, so a month before the election, that if Lincoln wins, and it looked like Lincoln was going to win at that point because of the sort of fraction in the Democratic Party, he said, if Lincoln wins, then some southern states are going to secede from the Union. We should take action now to prevent that from, if that happens, to have a response to it in terms of having military presence in the South. And Buchanan ignores that. The election happens, Lincoln wins, and Buchanan gives a very interesting State of the Union address in early December, so even before any southern states have seceded, but while people are starting to talk about that in terms of response to Lincoln's election. And of course, this is when they gave the State of the Union, wasn't in person, it was done in writing, so he sends this message to Congress, and he says a couple of interesting and contradictory things. He says secession is illegal. He says, I don't think the Constitution permits states to secede from the Union. But he also says that he, as president, has no authority to do anything to stop it. So, no, you can't, which is a kind of a message that's going to alienate pretty much everybody. Southern states who are thinking about seceding, he's saying, I don't think you can do this. They're going to push back on that. People who are in the North who are hostile to secession are going to, think he's not fulfilling the obligations of his office by saying basically he's powerless to do anything about it. He blames secession actually on abolitionists. He said if abolitionists weren't fomenting resistance to slavery, we wouldn't have this problem in the first place. And when Southern states start to secede, he basically says, or sort of repeats this message, I don't think you can do that, but I can't do anything about it. And try to make sense of why Buchanan is doing this. Buchanan's from Pennsylvania, but his political support is largely in the South. That was sort of the way he got elected into office, was by being a Northern Democrat with Southern sympathies. And that was sort of the structure of the Democratic Party at the time. And what happens in the intervening months is that he basically sticks his head in the sand. He ends up with very little of a cabinet left by the time he leaves office. Some of them resign, like Howell Cobb, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, because he's from Georgia. He resigns to go and be with Georgia. Some of his cabinet resigns because they think he's not doing enough. So Lewis Cass, who was Secretary of State, resigns because he thinks Buchanan has sort of abrogated the duties of office. Congress tries to sort of take up the mantle of leadership in this sort of vacuum, but they have a variety of proposals about how to sort of resolve things peacefully that don't go anywhere. And Buchanan leaves office, and he supposedly says this thing to Lincoln at their inauguration. He says, if you are as happy entering the presidency as I am leaving it, then you are a very happy man. he seemed like his whole presidency was kind of miserable, but especially those last few months hadn't gone. He really checked out after the election happened.
What could he have done differently, David? Because I think one thing, if we're going to either criticize or praise people for their actions in a crisis, we have to consider the alternative. So what should he have done?
So he could have done a couple of things. One is he could have listened to Winfield Scott, who was one of the sort of great military leaders of the early 19th century that people forget about. He was a hero.
Duke of Wellington said that.
Yeah, he hero from the War of 1812 and the Mexican War and was really instrumental in actually putting the Union on the right footing in the Civil War. People sort of forget about him because the one thing people know about him is that he ran for president and lost, and that he was too fat to ride a horse in 1861. If he had listened to Winfield Scott and actually said, look, there's a potential crisis that's on the horizon here, I should take military action and place troops in vulnerable locations in the South to secure federal property, then, that would have made secession that much more difficult and probably have prevented or at least changed the direction of the war that resulted. I mean, for instance, Robert Anderson, who is given command of federal forts in Charleston Harbor, shows up at the end of 1860 and is basically given no orders. And he writes continually to Washington saying, hi, I'm here, South Carolina, secession happens in South Carolina. What am I supposed to do? And he gets basically no response from anybody in Washington. And, he ends up sort of moving his command from one fort to another, to Fort Sumter, because he thinks that's more defensible. But he's really left on his own. And I think if Buchanan had taken a greater sort of hand in the crisis and actually sort of given people like Robert Anderson directions about what they were supposed to do, I think the secession crisis would have unfolded pretty differently.
How does Lincoln have... I mean, Lincoln doesn't have as much time, of course, because he's inaugurated in March and the war commences in April. How would you assess Lincoln's handling of the crisis?
That's an interesting question. Because he is elected in November, and he doesn't really give any public statements between when he is elected and his inauguration. And Lincoln has been criticized sometimes for not saying much publicly. He is doing a lot privately. He's sending a lot of letters to people sort of indicating where he stands on various issues, especially some of the things going on in Congress. But I think part of it is he feels that, at that point, he's a private citizen. He doesn't actually have any power to run the country until he takes the oath of office in March. When he does take office, I think he learns, for instance, that the crisis at Fort Sumter is much more pressing than he thought it was. He gets more military information about what's going on. He, at that point, is also trying very much to manage the crisis, right? And so at that point, by the time Lincoln is inaugurated, states in the Deep South, starting with South Carolina, have seceded from the Union, but there's still lots of slave states that are within the Union that have not seceded, including some states that will eventually will secede, like North Carolina and Virginia and Tennessee. And so, you know, one of the things he is trying very hard to do early in his administration, starting with his inaugural, is to keep those states from leaving the Union and from not doing anything that would alienate them. And so I think there's a fear that if they take over military action, that that's going to alienate slave states in the Union. If they take action against slavery, which is something that some people within the Republican Party want to do, then, you know, then that would also alienate slave states still within the Union. So Lincoln is just trying to sort of manage this crisis very carefully, recognizing he's got several sort of competing and obligations. And he tries very hard in his inaugural address to sort of balance those and to send different messages to different constituencies to make sure the crisis doesn't get any worse. But at that point, the crisis had already gotten pretty bad. The way he eventually ends up managing the crisis with Fort Sumter, where he sends a ship to Fort Sumter to resupply them, but indicates that the ship doesn't carry more weapons or soldiers, but is merely carrying food, and therefore pushes Confederates into firing first. I think that was actually a strategic managing of that particular element of the crisis that really spoke to Lincoln's favor. But he had a very limited set of options at that point.
Interesting. I mean, it seems to me that in assessing, if we're going to kind of compare across time periods and different circumstances, that presidential responses to crises operate on a couple of levels. There are the decisions that a president takes to kind of manage and respond to events. And then there's the president has a kind of unique role in the American context. It's not part of the Constitution, but it's a really crucial one, which is as a kind of communicator-in-chief. So the president's commander-in-chief, and some of these are military crises, but he's also, or she is also, a kind of communicator-in-chief whose role in communicating to the public both what the government is doing but how the public should respond is crucially important.
And that
that's
role
less
is
important in the 19th century, I think.
I think that's a role that's increasingly become more prominent as technology is made. Because Lincoln, for instance, could give a speech, telegraphs, disseminate it throughout the country, it's in the newspaper the next day.
Right. People have to sit down and read it and process it.
An FDR can give a fireside chat on the radio. And obviously now, we're at a point where president can tweet things and all of a sudden the whole world knows.
Right. But anyway, so I think we need to consider going forward in this discussion, think about those two levels, because I think there are kind of, those are the two main areas where presidents can deal with a crisis.
Sure.
I should, I while you were speaking, I did think that my boy Thomas Jefferson did deal with a crisis, not as president, but as governor of Virginia in 1781 when the British invaded the state, or the colony come state. And things didn't go very well for him.
Yeah, he ran away.
Well, that's a little unfair, but yes.
It's only unfair because you like him.
No, I am not. That's a mischaracterization. Anyway, but what's interesting is it's a bit like Buchanan. His situation is a bit like Buchanan because, well, the British invade the state repeatedly during his second term as governor in 1780 and 81. But his term was due to expire at the beginning of June. And the government of Virginia fled first from Richmond to Charlottesville, where he lived, and then from Charlottesville to Staunton, to the west. And Jefferson's term expired during that period. But the legislature was meant to pick the new governor, so the governor of Virginia in during the Revolution was a bit like a prime minister in that he was chosen by the assembly from its members. And so because the assembly wasn't quorate because they were all fleeing the British, they didn't get around to electing a successor. Jefferson took the view that, I think his term expired on June 1st. My term's up.
Yep.
It's not my problem. And then he did flee because the British attempted to capture him at Monticello, and so he ended up going down to Poplar Forest. But so when he went to Poplar Forest,
it's good to have lots of plantations to flee to.
It, He had two. Well, he had more than two. You're missing the point, David. So his interpretation was, well, I'm no longer governor. This isn't my problem. The interpretation of many contemporaries was, hold on, you kind of left the state without a governor in this crucial moment. So in a moment of crisis, he was not terribly decisive.
He's like Buchanan in that way.
Well, yes.
Except Buchanan was still actually technically
president. That came to me while you were speaking about Buchanan. So if I'm comparing Thomas Jefferson to James Buchanan, I'm hardly being flattering.
That's
one that occurred as you were talking. However, let's cast our mind forward, because I think the next big crisis that I think has a lot of resonances to what's been going on in the past couple of weeks is the way that Herbert Hoover responded to the stock market crash in October 1929 and the beginning of what we now know as the Great Depression. Now, I'm going to choose my words very carefully here, because I'm not a big fan of Herbert Hoover. I mean, I don't know many people who are. Except I've always thought, at some level, Herbert Hoover gets a bad rap.
I think Bill Luckenberg would agree with you.
Well, I guess so. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, if Hoover had never been president, he'd probably be remembered as one of the great humanitarians of the early 20th century. Sure. Because Hoover had acquired a reputation managing post-war relief and dealing, in fact, with the aftermath of the 1918-19 flu pandemic, especially in Europe. And he was a great humanitarian in terms of distributing humanitarian aid in Europe right after the end of the First World War. He counseled President Wilson against intervening in Russia during the Russian Revolution. And then he also, because of his reputation, and he had been a mining engineer before, and because of his expertise as a mining engineer, as an engineer, he was good at organizing projects, which is why he was given that role in response to the First World War and its aftermath. He was also, as Commerce Secretary in 1927, responsible for coordinating the response to the Great Mississippi Flood in 1927, and he did a pretty good job of that.
Yeah.
And so Hoover's reputation was not of... prior to 1929 was not the one he's had ever since. And the reason... So what happened in 1929, of course, is when the stock market was crashing in October. Of course, it's the beginning of his term. One of the things I forget is most of Hoover's term coincided with was overtaken by the Depression. But Hoover is derided and criticized, and frankly, there's a lot of justification for this, for what appeared to be his rather tepid response to the stock market crash. But his belief, which was an ideological belief, he believes in the free market and so on, is that he has to boost confidence. So the statements he's making, more or less cheerleading for the economy, while people are losing their homes and starving and conditions are getting worse and worse, to some extent, he's not unaware of human suffering, or not even unsympathetic to human suffering, but he recognizes in his role as communicator-in-chief, he has to be a bit of a cheerleader to try and keep, because the economy, confidence matters in a crashing economy. Yes. So am I being overly sympathetic?
I don't think you're being unfair. I mean, one of the things that...
And he cut interest rates, which is exactly what Trump did.
Yeah. Or the Federal Reserve. I mean, one of the things that Hoover did from the very beginning of his presidency was, you know, he saw what he was doing as a continuation of what had been happening in the previous 8 years with earlier under Harding and Coolidge, where, you know, he says in his inaugural, this is about the most optimistic inaugural I've ever seen. Ours is a land rich in resources, stimulating glorious beauty, filled with millions of happy homes, blessed with comfort and opportunity. Poverty will be banished from our nation, he says, in the near future, right? So it's like a very optimistic, like, things have been going well, things are going to continue to go well.
It's not exactly American carnage.
No, it's not, right? And like, he pitches this thing as like, okay, the policies that we've been using of sort of pro-business government have been successful. Now, his assessment of how the economy was doing in the 1920s was obviously problematic.
Arguably, I mean, one thing he did neglect was the fact that the agricultural sector was probably already in depression when he became president.
Well, so, but one of the things that was his priority in that sort of window before the stock market crashed is that he says, like, we need to have a federal response to this. And he wants, and his response is interesting, because for the farm crisis, he wants to create a federal farm board that's going to be sort of the equivalent of the Federal Reserve, but for farming.
So what would it do?
it would have given money to state and local farm cooperatives. Some people wanted to actually give money directly to farmers, and he said, no, that's a kind of statist government response that he thought was morally wrong. So he wants to create the sort of intermediate board that would facilitate farmers selling crops to cooperatives and then sort of using that as a way of bolstering the farm economy indirectly. So he's aware of that. He's aware of some problems with U.S. foreign policy. He actually thought foreign policy was going to be the sort of the big agenda of his administration. He gives lots of press conferences early in his administration. He was giving more press conferences personal, like not just like sending somebody off to do it for him, but like him speaking to the press in his first 6 months of his administration than any other president ever has. And then things go badly and he stops doing that. But he, you know, has this sort of very... positive, open moment in his presidency.
He's also not a very dynamic speaker.
No, he's not.
Or performer. So he doesn't understand the medium necessarily.
Well, you know, and when he was speaking to the press, you know, this is the point in which radio as a technology is really coming to the fore, and he's, you know, doesn't, you know, he realizes he's speaking to a room, but he's not going to realize he's speaking, therefore, to the nation in the way that, obviously, FDR was quite good at. You know, the response, though, that Hoover has when the stock market crashes in October, I think in some ways is very similar to the kinds of responses that lots of presidents have to financial crises, is to say, sort of to minimize how bad the crisis is, because if he says, look, the sky is falling, that's only going to cause the stock market to crash more. And the stock market is very responsive to sort of perceptions about how the economy is doing as much as it is about how the economy is actually doing. And of course, the stock market isn't the economy. It wasn't in 1929. It's not today. But it is there's a psychology to the ways in which the stock market responds to things. And Hoover is very much trying to sort of say things are actually going better than they were, or sort of to position things as being normal. To try to keep the stock market and consequently banks and other things from continuing to
I've got a story to illustrate this, which is many years ago. A close friend of mine was flying from Boston to Montreal during a very, very bad storm. And so there were high winds, there was rain, the plane was blowing around. And the pilot got on, as they always do soon after takeoff, and he says in that kind of calm Chuck Yeager voice they all use after the right stuff, saying, you know, well, you know, it's going to be a little bit bumpy, but, you know, we'll arrive in Montreal in an hour and a half, and it's all, you know, don't worry about it, just make sure you have your seatbelt on. And then when he thought he had turned the mic off, he switched to his normal voice and said, shit, I can't see a thing.
Right.
And you want the president, I mean, so the reason presidents respond as they do in apologies for my language, you don't want people... You want them giving the Chuck Yeager voice telling you everything's going to be all right, not the I can't see a thing response, because you don't want people to panic because they're trying to buoy the market.
Which I think we've seen a lot of Trump doing with this crisis, where he's been minimizing the number of people who have been diagnosed with it. He's been saying that the crisis is under control, that we have enough tests, both of which are not true. And so, you know, he's playing from a very well-developed sort of playbook
there. Well, he was very pleased on Friday when he gave one of his earlier press conferences, in which he more or less denied everything at that point, but the market rebounded when he had all those CEOs out to you know, so Walmart was sharing their parking lot
and
for testing.
Google and
the market, I was watching, I don't know whether you watched that live, but I did, and the market was going up while he was speaking. And then he was autographing pictures of the stock market curve, the graph on Friday. I don't think he was autographing them yesterday when he had record falls. But it's not... In retrospect, those statements appear incredibly callous and in the cold light of history. But to some extent, I think that underestimates the importance of the communication role of the president and at times like this. I don't think Hoover responded pretty well, effectively to the Depression.
Well,
but that initial response is what conditioned the way people, contemporaries, interpreted his his views and his handling of the crisis, mm-hmm. and he never really recovered from that, nor did the country. Mm-hmm. But I think there are actually reasons why they do it.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem, if you sort of look at sort of the rest of Hoover's response, whether it's the tariff in 1930, or the Reconstruction Finance Corporation in December of 31, or the kinds of things they're doing in 32, to try to stabilize banks and create public works. You know, by the time he leaves office, Hoover actually is doing a lot of stuff. You know, when the Emergency Relief and Construction Act that they passed in
July. Right, but he's presented as a do-nothing,
but
it's not true.
So, I mean, he's actually doing some pretty radical things that would have done a lot to sort of stem the Great Depression if he had done them 2 or 3 years before that, right? And, you know, the question with crises like this is not only what do you do, but when do you do it?
Right.
When is how does the timeline fit? And because of, you know, the ways in which I think part of the crisis that both the U.S. and the U.K. are facing right now is that the initial response to the COVID-19 outbreaks was inadequate, and now we're trying to play catch up afterwards, and that makes dealing with the crisis that much worse, and also undermines the faith that people have in the leadership and structures of power to deal with crises when they stumble over the opening.
Yeah, the U.S. and U.K. have been in kind of on parallel courses in the past couple of weeks in dealing with this. Not exactly, but it was very interesting because Boris Johnson yesterday in his press conference started to change course for Britain. I mean, he basically said, everything I told you last week don't really, you know, the science, we've taken another...
Science has now changed.
But he invoked the authority of science to say that. So it's our understanding of the science means that we now want you to, you know...
Mm.
Stay home and socially isolate. And I reckon that in the next couple of days, that's going to become a much stricter, I think we're going to have a much stricter regime, more akin to what we've already seen in continental Europe here in the UK. But they use science to justify that.
Well, the other way in which there's a similarity between the US and the UK in terms of their response, and obviously it's much smaller here in the UK, has to do with federalism, because the ways in which some health questions are devolved in the UK means that Scotland is not necessarily doing exactly the same thing as England is in terms of its response to this, in terms of the ways in which the government is situating these things.
Yeah, although in her interview this morning, the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, admitted, I don't know what the right verb is, that in terms of sort of closing... So although Scotland's taken a stricter view on... prohibiting public gatherings. She had to say that because these are businesses in many cases, actually only Westminster can formally prohibit them, which actually might have insurance implications and legal implications. So although these are recommendations, but you're right. Although it was interesting because the chief medical officer for England who keeps appearing with the prime minister often speaks of the four the four kingdoms and or his counterparts and consulting his counterparts. So you're right, there's a kind of federation or a federalist federalist light or something.
Yeah, thinking about the ways in which this is unfolding in the United States right now, you have the federal response, but you also have sort of the governors responding in radically different ways, with some saying we're shutting everything down, shutting down the schools, shutting down libraries and all the kinds of public services. And prohibiting gatherings of various kinds.
Interestingly, the governors of Connecticut, New Jersey, and New York acted in concert yesterday.
Yes. But you also have governors like in Oklahoma where they're saying, no, actually what we want you to do is go out and support businesses and spend a lot of money and everything's fine. One of those responses, I think, is extraordinarily irresponsible and will lead to people dying, but... there's a sort of a federalist issue to all these kinds of crises.
So FDR succeeds
yes.
Hoover, of course, and I'm not sure FDR inherits a crisis. He inherits a very bad situation. But if we're dealing with a crisis, it's a moment when something happens and a timely response matters. I mean, there is a crisis. There's a banking crisis when FDR is...
And an unemployment crisis.
But there are massive problems. But it's a long-running crisis at that point. So I guess you we can argue about whether... about the how important the time frame is, but communication. I mean, one of FDR's real gifts, but particularly by contrast with Hoover, is as a communicator.
Yeah.
And you know, so we have you have nothing to fear but fear itself, and so on. As his famous end, the fireside chats. He's very, very effective as a communicator. As we, I was thinking about this discussion today, David. I thought, well, you know, is 1941 a crisis for FDR? It's the attack on Pearl Harbor. And I don't think it is. It's obviously a major turning point, but it's just that, a turning point, because to some extent, I think the attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941 is a catalyst that allows FDR to do what he'd been gearing up to do since Lend-Lease in 1939, which is to enter the war. And so I... don't think he welcomed it. I don't believe in conspiracies about it. I'm not suggesting that in any way, but I don't think it's a, you know, he's ready to go. And so, you know, and that's when we're communicating, you know, Day of Infamy and so on, and asking for a declaration of war is all important. And he's helped out because, of course, Hitler declares war on the United States.
That's an interesting choice.
Well, in the sense that he doesn't, you know, arguably the United States should have declared war on Japan, which it did, but whether it would have declared war on...
Anyway,
it doesn't matter. Obviously, it does matter, but what I... you tripped me up with the helping out comment. But it's... I'm not sure 1941 is a crisis of the same kind, I think. Would you agree?
Well, I think that the choices that you know, sort of evolved from that were sort of obvious in some ways. You know, he made some rhetorically important decisions in terms of the way he positioned it, but one can imagine that most people in that role would have responded in very similar kinds of ways.
Well, I think one of the things we stipulated at the beginning of this discussion is these things have to be unexpected.
That is right.
And I don't... Well, the attack on Pearl Harbor might have been unexpected.
But the U.S. entry into the war is not.
A crisis that would... an event that would lead to the United States becoming involved in the war was not unexpected.
Well, so one of the things that you know, I think shapes the way people respond to crises is their... The sort of political and ideological framework that they're working from, right? And so one of the things that's, I think, shaped Buchanan's response to the secession crisis, he has a very limited conception of what the power of the president is, and part of the reason why he doesn't do anything is because he doesn't think he can do anything, and he has a you know, and if you buy into his assumptions about what the role of the presidency is, he did the right thing in that way. Likewise, Hoover has a particular... political and economic philosophy about the ways in which the economy works and the ways in which the federal government should have a role in the economy. And he was playing by the rules that handbook lays out, that the government should have a very light touch, if a touch at all, and that the economy will self-regulate and that things will get better on their own. And I think that constrains very much the ways in which Hoover, especially in the early months of the Great Depression, responded to it, because of course he assumes that things are going to return to normal because that's the nature of the ways in which the economy works in his mind. You know, likewise, thinking about the debates that are happening now, thinking about the ways in which Congress is debating various responses to COVID-19, you know, they're framing it in terms of what fits within my particular sort of ideological framework. And what does this mean for my assumptions about how healthcare is going to work? What does this mean about the role of the federal government in terms of collecting taxes or giving people who have been laid off or people who have been underemployed as a consequence of the crisis? To what extent is there a government response needed to that? You know, so the people are working from frameworks from when things are not in crisis time, and applying those in times where they may or may not fit. And so one of the questions, I think, of all these crises is how much are you going to be straitjacketed by the sort of assumptions about how things work and political philosophies about how things should be when things are not in crisis. You know, I think Trump has a fairly, in as much as he has a political philosophy, has a fairly expansive conception of what the presidency is can do. And so one wonders how he's going to apply that in this particular crisis. Because he hasn't done it yet.
No,
but
he hasn't done it. Well, I...
Because he's said, I'm not taking responsibility for things, but we'll see what he does in the future.
He has an expansive view of what the presidency should be or can be, but it's not a constitutional one. In other words, he's not a deep constitutional thinker. He just thinks he should have this power.
Yes.
But I don't think he understands how to deploy it.
Yeah. Or
effectively, necessarily. Yes. Anyway, we'll get to him, I'm sure. Yeah. So if we go forward then to the Cuba Missile Crisis of 1962, what do you think of the Cuban Missile Crisis, David? Exam question. Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Effective crisis management? Discuss.
Well, I think one of the things that... one of the things that JFK did during the Cuban Missile Crisis is, you know, is they get this information that there are being missiles in Cuba, based on photos taken by U2 spy planes. You know, the question then is, how do you use that information that you have early on in the crisis, recognizing that their time is of the essence? Recognizing that there are more missiles that are arriving from the Soviet Union into Cuba, and the choice then of how both you're going to respond to this as a military question, and then how do you respond to this as a political question. And one of the things that comes very clear, especially if you read sort of Robert Kennedy's book 13 Days, is that there was a...
Yeah, that's not biased.
Well,
sorry, go ahead.
It's an interesting read, yeah, even well, if is
he's well, a he's a principal in the drama, so we should read it. Yeah,
to be sure, is that there was a diverse there that there was a split of opinion between people who were in the military about how one responds to a crisis like this of a hostile foreign power with weapons 90 miles from Cuba that could lead to World War III and all kinds of things, right? The ways in which that was a destabilizing military crisis versus those people who were thinking about this crisis in political terms. And so in terms of thinking about how, you know, you respond to a crisis, you often have sort of different lenses that you use to evaluate what's at stake and what kinds of responses are feasible. You know, the choices that the Kennedy administration makes in terms of establishing a blockade, in terms of giving an address to the public from the Oval Office, explaining the nature of the crisis, in terms of using Adlai Stevenson and the UN to confront the Soviet Union about missiles. There's several sort of different layers of both communication and action that are happening simultaneously. And given that we're all still here to talk about this, I'm thinking he did a pretty good job.
Yeah, well, this is generally taken to be a example of effective presidential crisis management. Mm. And I think you're probably right. The one thing I would say, because I was thinking about this morning in anticipation of our chat, is, you know, his address to the nation on October 22nd, which is about halfway through the crisis.
Yeah.
If those 13 days in October, the crisis officially ends on October 27th. So it's still got a bit to run. And again, this is interesting. You know, I'm interested in the temporal aspect of this. So this is quite a consolidated, confined period of time.
It's 13 days.
It's 13 days. So it's 2 weeks. And in that 2 weeks, JFK does a pretty good job of managing this. The Soviet missiles are removed from Cuba. The United States removes its missiles from Turkey quietly a little while afterwards.
No quid pro quo, though.
Well,
yeah, except there was a quid pro quo.
Of course. But my point being, I wonder if the address to the nation on October 22nd might have been an error, because it raises the temperature. On one end, he has to inform the public that there's a danger of nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, so that people can prepare such as they might. If you read accounts or talk to relatives who lived through that, it was an unforgettable and terrible and terrifying moment. But it also raises the stakes and makes it more difficult for either one to back down, which is what you want. Now, that maybe that's deliberate, maybe it's not, but
But the alternatives, I mean, given that the blockade is being put in place, you can't put a blockade in place moving a large section of the Navy to do so without people becoming aware of it. You can't confront.
You can do. I mean, yes, you can.
Well, I mean, they sort of. Well, they lied about it, and they, you know, they said right. like initially, like, oh, it's just a drill. It's like, well, but people. Right. There were rumors happening within the newspapers. People were getting wind of things because you know they're sending more flights over Cuba, you know, and so they're you know the alternative is that it comes out in the press that the U.S. is doing this without the president addressing the country. So I think the choice is therefore to address the country was sort of a necessity because the alternative would be bad. You know, in order for Adlai Stevenson to confront the Soviets in the U.N., you can't do that until you've had the president give the address first.
Well, no, I agree.
Yeah,
with you.
But,
I
mean, but it did cause, in some ways, people to panic, right? If you think whether it was the right choice or not, it does cause. You know, part of the issue with crises like this is there's the underlying problem, and then there's the panic that people have in response to that, which may or may not be commensurate with the problem. So, if you're thinking about you know the Great Depression. Part of the reason why so many banks collapsed is in part because banks were loaning out money that they didn't have, but also because people were going and removing money from banks that were responsible banks and then causing runs on banks and causing banks to collapse. You know, likewise, right now people are running out and buying all the toilet paper despite the fact that there's no reasonable reason why one would need to buy toilet paper for this particular crisis. You know, and there's no pasta anymore in Tesco. So... You know, managing people's responses to crises is an important part of this because large groups of people, when they're confronted with novel situations, don't always respond in the most logical or healthy way.
Right, as we're seeing. Yeah. I mean, we're seeing in part because of the mixed messages coming out of various governments. I mean, we've seen people gathering in large groups, especially in the United States, whether it's students on spring break or people going to concerts or whatever,
Disney
or going
World.
To bars or Disney World, to somehow say they're not giving in. I don't understand the psychology of it, but people behave in strange ways, which is why managing the communication is important, especially in an era of mass communication. So Kennedy could address the entire nation basically with one television address. There was no Twitter, of course. There was no internet. There was no... and try to manage the communication, I suppose. And FDR, as we already said, was a master of this, really, using the technology available to him. I think President Trump is quite a skilled communicator at one level. I mean, his... at least to his base, communicating things. But he's not a comforter in chief.
No.
He's not somebody who can, I mean, a significant proportion of the country and the world simply don't listen to what he says.
Yeah. So I think the faith people have in institutions matters a lot in crises. How much faith you have in the president, how much faith you have in government generally, how much faith you have in the media. All these things matter. So during the Cuban Missile Crisis,
science.
Exactly. But like during the Cuban Missile Crisis, people trusted the president to be telling the truth addresses, and they trust the media when it responds or reports on these things that they will be telling the truth as far as they know it. You know, I think right now we're at a point where lots of the United States doesn't trust various media organizations because they've been told that it's all fake news, and so they're not responding the ways that one would hope they would when the media says, don't do various things, don't meet in public, don't whatever, you know, wash your hands, all these kinds of things. And they don't trust the president. So when the president says, yes, I had a test and I'm tested negative, lots of people say, well, you're lying, because he tends to lie a lot. You know, and so the fact that we don't trust our institutions, we're at a point right now where the faith of in specific individuals and institutions more broadly is at a as at a particular low point is makes the crisis that much worse, right? And so I think part of what makes crises bad is how much faith people have in things, you know, is in all the things that happen that lead up to the crisis that make them end up the way they do.
Yes.
So after the Cuban Missile Crisis, what were the
other? There are various other crises, but I think we should go for the George W. Bush hat trick.
Okay, George.
So I think there are three main. I mean, George W. Bush is unlucky in the sense that he has three major crises during his presidency. At the very beginning, there's of course 9/11. Midway through is Hurricane Katrina, and at the very end is the crash of 2008-09.
Yes.
And I think that's germane because I think it relates a little bit to the secession winter. So just to take each of those in turn, I think George W. Bush actually handled 9/11 reasonably well on the communications front. He understood the symbol, the kind of...
Yeah.
Consoler in chief aspect. So when he appeared on the pile at 9/11, when he went and threw out the first ball at the World Series, he had a misstep when he talked about a crusade, but he actually was pretty good in his messaging with regard to Islam and saying, you know, the United States is not at war with Islam. I think he mishandled the policy aspects of it. If we talk about this happening on other levels in terms of clearly the Iraq war.
Yes.
Yeah, I think attacking Iraq in response to 9/11 was a mistake. And to some extent, it's created the world we live in. I think some of the responses as far as the use of torture and so on are indefensible. But I think our conversations assume there are kind of two levels of crisis management and response. One is communication. One is the actual things you do is in policy terms. I think he got one of those right and one of them wrong.
Mm.
Katrina is not his fault in the sense that he didn't create the hurricane, although... His environmental policies aren't very good, but he totally mismanaged the communication aspect of that. Mm. The image of him flying over New Orleans and looking out the plane window.
Heck of a job, Brown.
Yeah, and heck of a job, Brown. He totally mismanaged the communication aspect of that, and they mismanaged the immediate aftermath of that. So I think Katrina, they just got wrong.
Well, and if you notice, one of the things that there's sort of a parallel between the situation right now and Katrina is the Brownie, whatever you remember, was first name. He, you know, was not a crisis management expert. He was not a public health expert. He was not, he's in charge of this huge government administration without having the expertise to go along with it. And I think right now we're also having the situation in which the Trump administration has appointed people who are loyal to Trump but don't necessarily have expertise for the jobs they're doing. Michael Brown, thank you. One of the things that worries me right now is the extent to which, you know, Jared Kushner seems to be in charge of half of the things in the government and his expertise don't extend to any of those things.
Yes, and the people who do have expertise, like Anthony Fauci, who is a remarkable figure actually in the history of public health and a really admirable figure. They have to, you watch these press conferences and they all have to praise President Trump before they try to get over whatever message they're trying to get over. And it's not terribly, that doesn't help with the messaging.
No, it does not.
Do you know how old Anthony Fauci is?
That's a good question. I have no idea. He must in the 70s, late 70s?
79. Yeah. I mean, he looks great.
Yeah.
But wow. So I think George W. Bush really kind of blew Katrina. And they... The people in that administration, including George W. Bush, more or less concede that point. I think they tend to say it was more a matter of messaging than management, but I think on both scores. The interesting thing about the 2008-09 crash, now, I'm not necessarily, I don't want to be seen as an apologist for neoliberalism or what have you, but Bush and Obama and their transition teams handled that pretty well in that we were on the verge of the kind of global economic collapse we seem to be in the midst of now, and pulled back from the brink in part because they communicated well with each other, collaborated, and acted decisively. Yeah. So I actually think George W. Bush should get pretty good marks for the response in 2008-09. I don't know what you think about
that. Well, I also think the Obama administration should get really good
marks. Well,
one of the things about...
In the role of Lincoln, analogy. Yeah. I think the Obama people acted really decisively as well.
And, you know, one of the things about these these crises like this, if you handle them well, they almost, you don't get credit for handling them well oftentimes. You know, that the Great Recession was really bad for a lot of people, but it could have been, as you point out, a whole lot worse.
Yeah.
And it's in large part because of the steps taken at that critical moment in terms of stabilizing banks and stabilizing the auto industry that really prevented that moment from being another Great Depression.
That's right.
And, you know, Obama didn't get a whole lot of credit for that. I mean, I think he gets credit for people who pay attention to policy things, but in terms of the American public, they don't think, oh, he's the guy who saved us from another Great Depression.
Yeah, so but I think I agree with you completely on that. Or he gets criticized from the left for bailing out capitalism and criticized from the right for this intervention, state intervention. But I do think W deserves some of the credit for that. I think the administrations worked very well together in that, because it started in right before the election in October, when John McCain suspended his campaign,
yes,
and then extended through the transition period. But you're right, the Obama people acted as soon as they got into office in January, decisively.
And one of the ways I think that sort of feeds into some of the conversations we're having today is that, you know, we've had previous disease outbreaks, you know, whether it's the
2009,
the SARS and swine flu, and I'm probably forgetting half dozen others of these things that were awful in terms of Ebola, but they didn't become the global pandemic that this is, in part because the response to them was very prompt and efficient, run by professionals from the very beginning. And the fact that, you know, part of the reason why I think this response has not been particularly great either here in the UK or in the US is because some people have said, oh, we have people worried about these things in these last few times and nothing happened, and therefore it's not a big deal.
Yes, whereas and the reason things didn't happen is because action was taken.
Right. You know, you don't, when you take actions, you don't know if you're over-responding to something, but you definitely find out if you're under-responding to these
That's
kinds
right.
of crises.
That, you know, you're absolutely right, David. So in fact, I saw somebody say that about messaging about social isolation and so on.
Yeah.
If this works, people will say we overreacted.
Right.
But let's hope that's what happens. But,
right. That's the positive.
But you're right. And I think the Obama administration was not characterized by crises because they didn't allow these things to become crises in a lot of cases.
Yes.
So, you know, he didn't put Sasha Malia in charge of the Ebola response. and they responded effectively. I think there were other qualities, but no, I agree with you about that. They created a pandemic response team within the National Security Council, which Donald Trump and John Bolton eliminated.
Mm.
And, you know, we could use that now. So I think that crisis in 2008-09 is a very interesting one. And I think it's in some ways akin to the, back to where we started, the transition from Buchanan to Lincoln. But in this case, Buchanan did pretty well before he handed over to Lincoln. So I think George W. Bush actually managed the early stages of that crisis very well, and I think Obama continued quite effectively. So I agree with you completely on that. Donald Trump is facing a challenge in the sense that while these two things are closely related and one has really caused the other, he's dealing with an economic crisis as well as this public health crisis and pandemic, and frankly an international crisis because this is a global pandemic, and the fracturing of international relations and the relationships of the United States over the past 3 years are starting to, you know, the consequences of that are coming
home. And the UK's Brexit vote,
right?
You know, all these kinds of things
Peace. So, but he is, as somebody on Twitter said, and I don't know who originally said it, but they deserve a lot of credit. We're living in a moment where it seems as though the 1918 flu pandemic married the 1929 stock market crash. So these things are going on in tandem, if you will, and I know they're related to each other. He seems particularly ill equipped to deal with this.
Well, you ever played the board game Pandemic?
I have not.
Oh, okay.
Well, you're usually my go-to guy for video games.
No,
I don't know.
I play board games too. I play a lot of board games. It's a wonderful game. May not be the right time. Dawson was playing it yesterday. My younger son was playing it yesterday with a friend of his. But the idea behind the game is you have four or five people playing, and you have to sort of prevent the disease outbreak. It's a cooperative game. The idea is that it's not the individual person wins. Like, you either all win or you all lose. But the only way you all win is if you all work together. And so when it's a person's turn, it's not as if everyone's acting individually and then saying, okay, I'm going to do this because I want to do that. It's like, should I do this? Oh, no, maybe I should do this other thing. We should all cooperate about how we're going to respond to prevent diseases from...
So President Trump, the thing reported yesterday that President Trump was trying to bribe a German company to get their vaccine research.
So
the wouldn't game, work in that
no,
game.
No, the game only works if everybody plays together. That's why it's a cooperative game. Otherwise, you all lose.
So you develop a vaccine while I build ventilators.
Exactly. Yeah, right, yeah, okay. Something like that. Right. And one of the things that struck me in terms of the global response to this outbreak is that there hasn't been any of that going on. That, you know, the European Union is doing one thing, but different countries within the European Union are responding in different ways. Some of them are shutting their borders, some of them are not. Some of them are establishing curfews, some of them are not. The UK is doing its own thing, and it's changing gears four different times. The US, you know, has sort of one response at the national level, but each individual state is sort of doing its own thing. And sometimes it's local communities making decisions because of the sort of federalist structure of the government. That might be a kind of political system that might work when we're not facing this kind of particular kind of global problem. But it's not going to work now. You know, this disease doesn't recognize political boundaries, and it doesn't recognize,
I agree with you. This crisis began, we think, in December in China. Became really, really acute in China by January. It's ongoing still in China, although they seem to have some control over it. Spread throughout the world subsequently, but really took off outside of China beginning in February.
Yes.
Right?
We think.
We think, yeah, we're not epidemiologists, but based on limited evidence, it might have been much more widespread than that earlier. Who knows? But with that timeline, we're now on. It's March 17th. It's Tuesday, March 17th, when we're recording this. I am in no way defending the response. I think the analysis you just provided is very accurate. In human terms, not in viral terms, not in medical terms, but in human terms, it's a relatively short period of time.
Yes.
And there are things they could have done earlier. I mean, the first case in the United States, I think, was January 20th. Trump said it's under control. There's nothing to worry about. They could have taken steps beginning then to start to, you know, stockpile masks and personal protective equipment for medical personnel and everything. All kinds of stuff. But it's not very long. So to some extent, the fact they've got it wrong... Mm. Doesn't mean they'll continue to get it wrong. In other words, maybe we'll see the kind of global cooperation.
So it'd be like Hoover, where it's...
Yeah, the difference is the time frame on this is really matters. Yeah. People are dying and delay equals death.
Yeah, well, I think we live in a much faster world now than we ever have, right? And I think you have this comparing this to sort of the flu epidemic at the end of the First World War. That
got spread by people on ships.
It took months. You know, that unfolded over a couple of years.
Yeah.
Right? And this, we don't live in that world anymore in terms of... But on the other hand, governments have all kinds of powers now that they didn't have 100 years ago in terms of their ability to respond to things when they make a choice to do something.
Yeah, I mean, Spain, France, and Italy have responded decisively in the past two weeks.
Yeah, we don't need to send somebody on horseback telling people to close all the pubs. We can... You can send an email to everybody instantaneously saying close all the pubs.
And by the end of the week, I think that's where we're going to be.
Right.
Here. I don't know, but I think that's where we're going.
Right. We can have surveillance drones telling people to stay off the thing.
That's right.
The government's opportunities and people's opportunity to think about crisis response is constrained, right? There isn't a moment for reflection about how should we respond. You have to prepare for the crisis before the crisis happens.
Yeah, this isn't Nootka Sound where you can say, okay, now we're going to write this. Everybody, write your opinions about what we might do if Spain and Britain go to war 18 months from now.
Exactly, right.
You know, so, but given how fast things move, I mean, it's still early days.
You know, but when thinking about all the times of, you know, thinking about the Cold War context, all the times that the people did war games, because in, you know, if World War III were to break out during the Cold War, you don't have time to respond to it. I think we need to be doing that kind of preparation for things like disease outbreaks. And I know they have been doing that, but they haven't been, clearly they haven't been doing them well enough that when it actually happens, they follow through on the actual recommendations.
Well, we will undoubtedly probably be returning to this. I mean, one thing we might consider in a future episode, I think we're done. we're finishing, is how this might affect the election and how exogenous effects affect events affecting elections and things like that.
So the one final thought that I have is that with a lot of these crises, one of the things that happens is you end up opening up the... there's political space created by crises for ideas that have been sort of talked about but not implemented. Because crises cause people to reevaluate things they said were impossible.
Yeah, Medicare for All suddenly is looking
looks a lot better. Right, like Mitt Romney was talking about giving every American $1,000 a month, which, you know, universal basic income, an idea that a month ago was a crazy left-wing idea, and now Mitt Romney, who I guess is the one guy left in the middle, who knows, right? But there's a window that gets created by crises that create, that allows for creation of new political ideas. And you saw that during the Great Depression. We will see how that unfolds. Now, it also has the opportunity for people to make really stupid or bad policy decisions in the crisis. We can think about 9/11 and the kinds of legislation that got passed and votes that got made on military action, because it seems like we need to respond.
Yeah, it could give you the Social Security Act, or it could give you the Patriot Act.
Exactly. So things speed up, and who knows.
But you're right. It might be the... And again, let us make very clear, we are not trying to... We're not downplaying the significance of this. Mm-hmm. Quite the contrary. But it might give the space to break the kind of real logjam and the kind of ossification of American politics that's happened, where people are just in hard and fixed positions and won't compromise on anything. This virus doesn't care about your politics.
That is true.
And this is the challenge that President Trump has faced, because he's been very effective as a communicator at seeing off most of the other challenges to his authority and to his presidency, whether it's the Mueller report or impeachment, by managing,
And he's
scaring people with tweets. The virus doesn't care.
With the exception of Hurricane Maria, which he botched.
That's right.
He has not faced a particular crisis in his presidency. And so, you know, as...
Well, that wasn't of his own making.
It wasn't, exactly, right? So, which isn't a crisis. That's a, there's not been an external threat in the same way.
Although Hurricane Maria doesn't give us much cause for optimism.
No, it does not.
All right, we talked earlier about our last drops, as we usually do before we start, and we actually decided we're going to forego those this week, because we haven't given up drinking.
No.
Although we're not day drinking, just so you know. Not yet. but we thought that next week, depending on events, and of course we may be overtaken by events, we're anticipating that we'll probably be recording remotely next week, so I'll probably be here and you'll be at your home.
We live like... 3 blocks away from each other. So
we could hang out the window and shout at each other. Or we could sing like the Italians on their balconies.
I think people would tell us to be quiet at that point.
That we want to talk about what to do while you're locked down. So we're looking for two things from our listeners. Email or message us on Twitter or social media. Questions you might want us to answer. We'll do a mailbag. But we also want suggestions of things to read, watch, and listen to during so the kind of things we often talk about during our last drops. We're not going to do that this week. We're going to wrap up now. But if you could email either questions to us and or suggestions for things to watch, read, and listen to while we're all on lockdown.
Yes, the other thing, I'd listen to all of our back episodes.
Right, of course. Yes. The other thing we should say, though, is two things. We want to wish our listeners nothing but good health and good mental health as you deal with this. We recognize that this is going to be tough, and it's probably going to be tough for a prolonged period of time. And hats off and nothing but respect and admiration for healthcare workers around the world who are dealing with this.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway.
And wash your hands.
Yes, and wash your hands. So David, till next week.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.